What do you want of me?
Get off my world.
Get off my world. It belongs to me. If you can't handle rejection, then I think you better leave. You can call us fanatics, but the truth is we're hardcore. We love everything there is to know about you know who and more. Get off my world. It belongs to me. Get off my world. It belongs to me.
I just do the best I can.
Hello, I'm Joshua.
I'm Kelvin.
And I'm Pat.
And this is Get Off My World, a podcast featuring three middle-aged guys and their middle-aged tech guy, too, just to round out the middle age. And we love the classic Doctor Who series. And when it suits us, as Kelvin said last time, we like the new series, too. Mm-hmm. Today we will take you through five rounds rapid and get to the bottom of what's great and not so great about our favorite show. And as always, we start with round one, temporal grace, because we can get a little cranky about Doctor Who from time to time, so we want to reset ourselves in a little positive mood at the top so we can just be utter bastards by the end of the podcast. And this is our temporal grace, where we try to say something nice about Doctor Who. Kelvin?
Well, my temporal grace is, I think I stumbled onto on Facebook. I tried to find the name of the guy who is doing this, and I honestly couldn't find it anywhere on the page or anything. But there is someone doing something called Avenue Who.
Puppets?
He's making puppets of all the doctors.
Of course he is.
And, you know, like full-on classic Jim Henson Muppet kind of puppets. All he's made so far are the 12th Doctor and the 7th Doctor.
Bold choices.
I'm a little on the fence with the 12th Doctor one because I don't really quite know how you Muppetize Peter Capaldi's face.
He would look like the Muppet Eagle.
Yeah, kind of. He would look like Sam the American Eagle, yeah. But the 7th Doctor puppet is amazing. It is super Muppety, and it is so clearly the 7th Doctor, and there are some pictures
on... Are you sure it's not just the 7th Doctor?
No, there are some pictures of the guy showing the 7th Doctor puppet to Sylvester McCoy, and Sylvester McCoy could not be more overjoyed looking. He's just like, this is amazing! And there are sketches of his designs for a 4th Doctor and a 10th Doctor puppet, which he hasn't built yet, apparently.
Well, we will link to this in the show notes.
It's pretty fun. I don't know if he's got, like, a huge project planned or he's going to do, like, a puppet show thing, but they're amazing puppets.
Well, if he needs someone to write lyrics for his musical, I think we're available.
Yep.
Well, my temporal grace is I've been enjoying? Maybe that's not the right word. Maybe this is not a temporal grace. But by the time this comes out, this will be old news to fans because we record these things pretty far ahead, but there's just been a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff coming out about Doctor Who lately. Christopher Eccleston has been really opening up about his time on the show and specifically why he felt so uncomfortable, and then I just recently read an excerpt from Stephen Moffat's Day of the Doctor draft where it was the 9th Doctor and not the War Doctor. Oh. And that just made me a little sad because I love the War Doctor, love John Hurt, mm-hmm. but just for closure, it just would have been so awesome to see Christopher Eccleston. And so I don't know where I'm going with this. This isn't that happy. It's kind of made me sad. It's interesting, though, how time passes. Earlier on, I really wanted to know what was the deal with Christopher Eccleston. Why did he leave? And now it just kind of seems like water under the bridge and a little sad that he left after only 1 year. Yeah. But I'm also wearing this great Doctor Who shirt that I stole from my son. That'll be my positive thing. Yeah. I'm switching nice gears. Shirt, sorry, I got really sad. But my son found this Doctor Who shirt that's Doctor Who and the Daleks, though. The logo is from the Peter Peter Cushing movie, and it looks almost like a velvet painting kind of thing.
That's a more
TARDIS.
Realistic night sky than
the TARDIS
from that
in a
movie.
Swamp, it looks like.
Yeah. And I really like it. I like that my son's old enough that I can steal his clothes. That's also really awesome.
It's the very unconvincing swamp set from the first Peter Cushing movie, but done in a black velvet style that looks more convincing than the movie did.
Yeah, I look at least 10 years younger in this shirt. You guys can't see this, but just trust me.
No,
it's a fine.
You're right, Josh.
Yeah.
No,
Pat can't keep his eyes off me. I'm going to be his temporal grace.
We love you, Josh. Well, Josh, you've made me a little sad, and so I wasn't sure what I was going to do for temporal grace. So I think instead I'm going to do a temporal disfavor. And so what I find temporally disfavorable today is I recently read that Big Finish. Big Finish is going to do a series of Lady Christina audios. For those of you who might not remember, Lady Christina was the character played by Michelle Ryan in the Russell T. Davies, David Tennant classic Planet of the Dead. Which might actually be my least favorite Doctor Who episode of all time, and much of it was because of her character. So,
but the internet was crying for solo adventures featuring her.
It clearly was, because they're doing a 4-episode series written by Usual Suspects, Matt Fitton and those guys, and those are coming out later this year. And, you know, to increase my disfavor, I also discovered, while I was looking up the links to this, that there is a Jenny the Doctor's Daughter series of Big Finish audios that are also.
I'm genuinely shocked those hadn't been made yet.
Yes. I have nothing against Georgia Tennant or anyone in her family, but Jenny was also a character I had no desire to revisit in any way whatsoever, but apparently Matt Fitton and John Dorney and the rest of the people do, because there's a 4-episode series of them coming out. So I guess the graceful part of this is that I'm happy that Big Finish isn't going to run out of ideas anytime soon. So good for them. They're going to keep in business. But now I'm second-guessing myself. I don't think I should end on that note, so I think I'll do an actual temporal grace, if you'll indulge me.
I will indulge you. Let's lift people up.
So I saw a clip, and we'll link to this in the show notes, too, of some interviewer on some red carpet somewhere interviewing a whole ton of celebrities, just from all various walks of life. And the sequence was edited so that she was saying, oh, and did you know that there's a female Doctor Who now? What do you think about that? And the celebrities were giving their various answers. And among them were people like Tom Hanks and Andrew Lloyd Webber and Emilia Clarke, Jimmy Jam, Faith Evans, Meryl Streep, Sting, and Shaggy. The two of them together.
And none of them said, what's Doctor Who?
You could tell that some people were like, yeah, I'm really enthusiastic about this. Somebody I didn't recognize said, yeah, my kid watches Doctor Who, and I'm really excited that blah, 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 such and such, right? But most of them were, yeah, women, go. Yeah, that's wonderful. It's about time. And some of them were clearly like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah.
My favorite, though, was from Christiane Amanpour. The newscaster who really got into it is like, yes, I absolutely think that women in all walks of life should be there. It's about time for Doctor Who and blah, blah, blah. So I will link to this in the show notes.
What about Shecky Green?
That's a real missed opportunity. So for our second round tonight, our special topics Dalek, Joshua, you have a topic for us.
I do, and it is inspired by one of your two temporal graces, the more sour one.
We're in inspiration, Coleman.
So, as Pat mentioned, Big Finish is now trying to mine the new series for these spin-off box sets, including Lady Christina, the Doctor's Daughter.
Churchill.
Churchill, Riversong. And it made me think, wow, the classic series makes way better spin-off box sets. And so I think it's an interesting discussion twofold. Do you think the side characters in the new series are not as interesting as the classic series? Or is Big Finish picking the wrong characters? That's prong A of my special topic, Dalek. Prong B would be, is there something you would really like to see in either the classic or new series that Big Finish has somehow, in their drive to cover every single character who's ever appeared in all of Doctor Who, they should get a box set?
Well,
the only big finish new series spin-off idea that just struck me is like, why on earth are you doing that? Would be the Winston Churchill one.
Yes.
I mean, Jenny, I think, and the jewel thief lady, I think those lend themselves pretty naturally to news stories. I mean, I don't want to listen to them so much, but those seem like very fine jumping off points. But the Winston Churchill.
it's so they can do World War II stuff with Doctor Who aliens, I mm-hmm. assume, without having to get a Doctor Who actor to appear in it, which... I guess I understand the rationale for it, but I agree with you, Kevin. Yeah, yeah. I think it's pretty dumb. Mm-hmm.
And, full disclaimer, I have not heard the Winston Churchill.
I haven't. Yeah, yeah, I haven't heard any of these. So
they might be brilliant beyond words.
Yeah, well, also table the discussion that Churchill was a war criminal and it shouldn't probably be as revered as he actually is for our World War II podcast.
In classic internet fashion, we are bitching about things we haven't actually read.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That is our privilege as old white men, Colin.
Yes.
However, Big Finish is trying to sell these. That's how they make their money. And so if the concept doesn't sound appealing, in one way they have failed, right? Because they need to lure the money out of our pockets to get us to listen to this. So mm-hmm. I think it is fair to judge the attractiveness of these things as concepts. I think, yes, there is a setup for both Lady Christina and for the Doctor's daughter. But it's weird that they are both from, not just in our podcast, but I think generally in fandom, two episodes that are really low-rated episodes. They're going to have to rejuvenate these characters in the way they had to rejuvenate Mel.
Okay, wait, are we talking about Planet of the Dead and
the Doctor's daughter?
And the Doctor's, okay.
Yeah, let's not talk about those things.
Well, yeah, let's. I think those are well-regarded stories with some segment of Doctor Who fandom we just don't have a lot of intersection with.
I think it's safe to assume that Big Finish would leverage every possible thing that they could,
mm-hmm.
but they can only get certain actors
yes.
to do it, right? So, like, Michelle Ryan is available mm-hmm. and Georgina Moffat is available, and they'll be able to do that, whereas a much better idea might be to touch your first prong would be to have stories with, like, Amy and Rory, for example,
yeah.
back mm-hmm. trapped out in time, you know, former companions of the Doctor who know a lot about aliens and are, you know, good
that
actors.
Cool.
That, yeah, mm-hmm. I agree. That,
well,
that
Lady
cool.
Vastra and Jenny would be far more popular than Lady Christina.
And they are doing those.
Are they?
I think they are.
I have not heard that.
Well if only there was some method by which we could check this.
Have any of the 10th Doctor and Donna things come out yet?
They have?
Okay.
And they're quite entertaining.
I have this vague memory that there was going to be an audio of various companions from the old series, and one of them was Aramim. There was going to be an Aramim solo story.
I think you might have had a stroke.
They did a solo series with Charlie, the 8th Doctor's audio-only companion.
But there,
I had a stroke.
There was going to be an audio story with Aramim, and judging from the preview art, it looked like it was going to be set during the siege of Stalingrad.
Oh.
Because it had like a big hammer and sickle and like World War II kind of imagery. How did Aramim wind up in the siege of Stalingrad?
But it makes you want to listen to it.
Yeah.
Because she's an ancient Egyptian princess, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But she wasn't in that many audio stories, really.
No, we heard one. We talked about one in this podcast, I mean.
Strax did show up in a classic series Doctor Who spinoff, Jago and Lightfoot, which might have been what you were thinking, but there are no plans that I have read.
Madame Vastra didn't appear in Jago and Lightfoot?
Nope, it's just Strax, who regularly does other Santarin voices for Big Finish, so it might come back to your point of
they might be just around the corner.
Available. Yeah.
Yeah, circling back to my original point, it's mostly, I think, just whoever can do it, they'll allow to do it, mostly. They've even allowed Matthew Waterhouse back on, right? So if they could get Karen Gillan, who's busy doing Marvel movies right now, I'm sure they would love to do it.
Well, if they could get Matt Smith, they would love to do that.
Right.
I think there is something more interesting about the passage of time and going back to these classic Doctor Who spin-offs, because these are things that you thought were long gone.
Yeah,
to do the Time War, because that brought back Leela on Gallifrey, brought back Lala Ward as Romana and K-9, and so maybe that has more appeal to these old school fans.
Yeah, and I think we might be getting to the end of that rush of nostalgia too, because when Big Finish started doing these late 90s, around 2000, somewhere around then. Mm-hmm. I don't remember. To hear Peter Davison and Colin Baker and Sylvester McCoy doing these roles again, and then to think around the corner could be, oh, Tom Baker could do it. Paul McGann's in there now, whatever. This was a lot of untapped potential for old fans like us, and some of the old writers were doing it, and some of the good writers in the books were doing it. So it really was kind of a rush. They've now cleared through a lot of that, right? And so even if Amy and Rory were to come back, and I think that that would be fine, I think that'd be a fun idea, I don't know that it could have the same level of joy for a new series fan that some of that old stuff might have had for us, because we'd just been waiting so long for those kind of stories to be told again.
And we didn't think it would ever happen.
No, it seemed impossible.
Yeah, and now we're like, well, when are they going to get Matt Smith back? Are they going to get Peter Capaldi? Right, let's go. Come on, he's been off the air for 3 months.
When are they going to recast Patrick Troughton? Come on, guys, get on it.
Yeah, so there's a different fan expectation that exists now. And so it is just not as sweet a high anymore. So, we have a certain audio tolerance to these characters coming back.
Yeah, and to go back to your original question, I don't know that there's something inherently more interesting about the old series secondary characters than the new series ones. It's not like the old show was qualitatively different than the new one, generally speaking. It's only that it has that built up, what could they possibly do when this actor comes back after 30 years thing, an element of surprise where they're probably not going to do something very surprising with Alex Kingston when she comes back as River Song for the 10th time. Yeah.
Yeah. They also have far more perspective with the classic series, so they can choose characters that after 30 years they're pretty confident are the beloved characters. Yeah. They know we all love Jago and Lightfoot, which on the surface seems like a ridiculous idea, but stories I've heard have just been charming. And also with the new series, they have just the respect level we have for the actors. So getting John Hurt, that's a no-brainer. Derek Jacobi, the War Master audios, which we hope we will talk about sometime in the near future, are awesome.
To finish up this discussion, should we talk just quickly about who would we like, who hasn't come back, old series or new series?
Maybe like something about that's set on the parallel universe that Rose winds up on with the 10th Doctor's clone. Maybe like something within that universe, which would probably not be the same as what's in our universe. The main Doctor Who universe.
Russell T. Davies claimed that was an idea he had for a legit spinoff in the early days of Doctor Who. So I wonder if he's still sitting on that idea and won't give it to Big Finish, because I'm sure they would love to do that, and wouldn't surprise me if they did. I mean, honestly, it's not a full spinoff, but the thing that gave me the most nerdy excitement, and I know they sold very poorly, was having Frobisher pop up with the Sixth Doctor.
Yeah.
And I would love to listen to an entire Frobisher box set and see him team up with all the various Doctors. I'd love to see him pop up in a new series Doctor.
Mm-hmm. Well, as usual, Josh, you've been reading my mail, because I thought I would love to see a box set of Duggan from City of Death, the worthless schlep of a private detective. And I thought, like, he could have a very efficient Veronica Lake-style secretary who's always doing her nails or whatever, who's really the smarts behind the operation, and they'd and they'd fight aliens and stuff. And then it would be revealed that that's Frobisher.
That's it. Pitch it to Big Finish. We're
Fame
done.
And fortune.
Next up, the randomizer has, in its infinite random wisdom, given us The King's Demons, the Fifth Doctor story from the end of season 20, written by Terence Dudley and directed by Tony Virgo and produced by John Nathan Turner.
Terence Dudley wrote Black Orchid, Canine and Company, and your favorite, Four to Doomsday.
Well, hey! If he wrote Four to Doomsday, he can't be all bad.
This is way better than Four to Doomsday.
Tragically underrated story. I'm just gonna...
Don't throw Kelvin off his game here while he's introing the round.
Okay, so of course The King's Demons is set right about the time of the signing of the Magna Carta.
March 1215.
And of course features a disguised master.
Disguised?
A barely disguised master. And of course the greatest of all companions, Chameleon.
He is a complex mass of artificial neurons.
He is a complex mass of artificial neurons, and apparently is capable of independent thought unless someone dominates him.
Like most Americans.
Save it for our Trump podcast, Joshua. So, Game of Thrones, this is not.
Much smaller in scope.
Two episodes, in fact.
Yes.
Yes, in fact, this entire story could fit into one episode of Game of Thrones with room to spare.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a seriously underrated story. I don't think it's a classic of Doctor Who.
Yeah, I...
But I seem to remember it being really disliked. So after I watched it, and for the most part thoroughly enjoyed it, decided to Google King's Demons reviews. And it is just murdered. Every online Doctor Who reviewer just rips it to shreds. And I'm going to confess right at the top, I understand its faults, but I think most of its faults are faults that most Doctor Who stories have.
You're confessing.
I'm confessing.
Even without being put in the iron.
I largely agree with you. I think people are overly harsh on it.
You know what I think? I think it's half a story. I don't think it's a full story. I think mm-hmm. there's a couple things there that work, mm-hmm. and then it just sort of evaporates. I think it should be at least four episodes. It's two.
It's basically there to introduce Chameleon, who mm-hmm. winds up only being used as like an afterthought in Planet of Fire.
Mm-hmm.
But would people be as obsessed about that fact if the Chameleon robot just died at the end of this? Would people be fine with Chameleon? The baggage of Chameleon going into the TARDIS and never showing up again is a shadow over this story. Like, people blame this story somehow mm-hmm. for that.
Well, even if Chameleon were not there, or as you said, he just sort of evaporated, there still would not be a full story. So the Master comes in with motiveless malice, as far as we can tell. I mean, he gives some sort of retroactive, I'm going to undermine the civilizations of the universe, which seems like a fairly roundabout way of doing all this. A little British-centric, too, to think that...
Disrupting the Magna Carta would be pretty big.
Yeah. Probably things happening in China around this time that would also be big, but, you know...
Yes, of course, but...
The characters are good. I actually like the actors. Mm-hmm. I think Gerald Flood is a bit overdone as King John, but okay.
But he's an evil robot playing King John, and in that way, he's perfect.
Yes. I think Sir Geoffrey and Sir Randolph and Isabella are actually fairly good characters played mm-hmm. by old-school British character actors who have probably mm-hmm. done this 200 times on stage. And, of course, they can drag out all the horses and swords and castle stage sets that they want, and they could probably do a halfway decent job even without a script. Yeah. Right? But that's sort of where I am with it, right? There isn't much of a script. The Master has Chameleon impersonate King John for reasons of his evil own,
mm-hmm.
and then there's a couple other people swirling around, some of whom are abstractly evil because they're working for the Master, and some of them are kind of nice fellows.
There was a rumor for many years that this was intended to be a story for the Monk.
I've heard that debunked.
It's been disproven, but it seems more like a meddling Monk kind of thing to do than a Master kind of thing to do.
It sure does.
I'm just going to show up in some era and screw this thing up just because I can.
I'm going to disagree. No, it does seem like a Monk pod.
Yeah.
However, I think it works for the Master, as in it has that quality that the Master often has, the Delgado Master often had, of this is just petty and evil. It's wings off flies. And honestly, as plots go, it makes way more sense than Legopolis. I'm going to hold the entire universe hostage with this...
The breathtaking
space CB radio I've somehow concocted.
The breathtaking scale of that.
It's
great.
So breathtaking that it's just preposterous. I think this plot makes way more sense, even though it's massively time consuming to go from planet to planet and destabilize their democracies and civilizations. I think it has this pettiness that has always been there with the Master. And it is in contrast to other stories, so I think it's refreshing. It's this small, petty story. Literally.
It's small
and petty.
I actually enjoy the story. Mm-hmm. When I watch it, I enjoy it. It's funny. It doesn't seem, as I say, it doesn't seem long enough for what it is. It doesn't have space to breathe. We don't have enough characters or enough time with the characters to really care about any of them, but you wouldn't necessarily want it to be much longer either, honestly.
No,
kind of drag it four episodes.
It is sort of a weird throwback to First Doctor era,
kinds of stuff where it's almost purely historical.
It does have one of my favorite Anthony Ainley moments, though, by the way, when Sir Geoffrey is galloping off to talk to the real king in London. He gets a crossbow bolt in his back and falls off the horse, and then it cuts to the crossbow man who has just shot him, and the master's there, and he claps the guy on the shoulder.
I've written my notes too.
Good, excellent shot. It's like,
and it's really small. It's really encouraging. Like, you know, I think you have a future in shooting people with crossbows.
Yeah, really
God bless you, man.
Yeah. Like, what's your name again? Oh, I'm gonna. Yeah, okay.
You know, I'm sure,
see me later.
If you ever need a recommendation on your resume,
I'm sure it gets ridiculed by a lot of people. But when the master's disguised as Sir Gilles, Sir Gilles Estram,
yes. Better makeup than in Time Flight.
I could kind of see myself when this was being aired that I think Anthony Ainley does a terrific job of being a different character here. Like, and I think I might not have gotten that it was the master.
The accent is not French. And I'm not sure what it is, but...
Yeah.
Every planet has a France. Right? He's just doing the
Lots of planets have a north and lots of planets have
French
a
French accent. It seems like in the first half of the first episode, the director goes out of his way to not give us a clean shot of Ainley's face. And then kind of gives up on it as it goes. Because at first I was like, ooh, they're being clever. You just see the back of his head, or you see him briefly in a long shot. But then by the very end of the episode, they give you enough time to look at his face and see that, oh, that's Anthony Ainley.
The union was going to turn off the lights in a few minutes. Oh, they can't afford the new setups.
He was like, oh, artistry is out the window. It's time to get this
So I intended to at least reread Shakespeare's King John before watching this, but I ran out of time. I hope you guys will forgive me. So
nope.
You and your elaborate research.
You die.
Yeah. And I also didn't read any more historically accurate histories of the period. So I don't know whether the Doctor is being correct in his reevaluation of King John, because he spends a certain amount of time lecturing Tegan there.
That struck me because, King John is always... I guess because of the Robin Hood stuff, he's always portrayed as like one of the dumber, more evil kings of English history. But
I think they were all pretty dumb and evil.
Yeah, but you know, the Doctor defends him. You know, for his era, he was pretty decent.
He wanted to sign Magna Carta, he says.
Yeah.
Did he? I don't know. Our English listeners can maybe tell us whether that's true or not.
Yes, American public school education, we don't really hit the Magna Carta very much.
I did read a history of the British kings not long ago, but of course, in the manner of things, it just has evaporated out of my head.
Yeah.
Other things of interest, the Master-Doctor sword fight harkens back to the classic days of the Sea Devils.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting. Last time we had the Fourth Doctor getting into a direct fist fight with a Sontaran, and now we have the Doctor and the Master sword fighting.
And what struck me is that I would much prefer a slightly awkward, slower sword fight featuring the actual principal actors than the obvious stunt doubles of the Sontaran experiment.
Which was done because of injuries.
Yeah,
but still. But still,
it was fun to see the two of them very clearly doing the entire sword fight.
You don't see medieval broadsword, like, I'm just going to bash you with this thing kind of sword fights very often. Not on TV, anyway. Not on American TV.
Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And I really liked the moment where the king makes the Doctor choose between putting Geoffrey or the Master into the Iron Maiden.
Sure.
And it's one of those times where the Doctor makes the obvious right choice. Yeah. Mass murderer or this totally innocent guy? Right. Okay, put the Master in the Iron Maiden. The look on his face, Peter Davison's face, as the Master screams as he's being put in the Iron Maiden, and then the TARDIS sound, and then the completely other, oh, F me look on his face as he hears that is just priceless.
I think that's the best part of the episode. Yeah. It's a good sequence, and it's based on good acting, and it's genuinely surprising in a way that the rest of the episode is not. It's like, oh, we've seen the Iron Maiden there the whole time, but we didn't think, of course, it's his TARDIS. Of course, he's going to don't throw me in the briar patch.
The second best part of the episode is the Dalek bumps on the Iron Maiden. Yeah. And there's that episode when they carry it from the dungeon to the throne room, and the one guard uses the Iron Maiden breast as like leverage to lift it up. Yeah, he grabs it and picks it up. And God,
I'm going to lower my voice here. I think the Iron Maiden is a fictional thing too. I don't think it actually existed during this period. That's
I think there's some debate about that. Yeah,
yeah. I'm not talking about, you know, 2 minutes to Midnight, Number of the Beast, rockin' Iron Maiden. I'm
there
talking
is,
about, you know, actual.
There is.
Like, I know they didn't.
Thank you so much for clarifying.
I do know that there is no historical evidence of people being made to walk the plank.
Oh, really?
In the pirate era, that's like apparently totally fictitious.
What?
What are you?
What are you doing to me?
You're ruining my night here.
I'll spend a moment appreciating King John's song,
which is
written by Terence Dudley. It's not a period song, but it feels period appropriate, mm-hmm. even though it's not something that would ever have been written in 1215. I don't think Gerald Flood he's no Christopher Lee. He can't deliver those lines.
However, it's really nice to see Doctor Who take that moment in a two-part episode, no less, mm-hmm. and just let the king sing. It's a very short song, but do this montage of them all eating and have him sing. I really love that.
That's partly why I'm kind of fond of it, is just presenting the Middle Ages. I mean, the music playing, and it's just people like, ha-ha, eating. And,
yeah, you know. I mean, you guys, I like what's there.
Yeah.
I just think that what's there is not very much. It's like you tore a couple random pages out of a novel.
I'm going to argue it again. I love how little is there. As in, how small scale the Master's story is, all the Doctor has to do is grab his robot. And he really has foiled his plot, and it is that simple, and it's a two-part story, and it has all these little character moments, and I love that. It's not a classic.
But Josh, they just left. That's like all they did. They took Chameleon and they left. Even Tegan thinks that's a bad idea. The Master is still there with everyone. We don't actually know that he didn't murder every single person in that castle before the scene of him getting into his TARDIS and going away. They just foiled the plan of one of the most evil people in the universe. Well, and they're see ya.
We'll find out in Big Finish's King John box set.
So I think for our fourth round, I want to do something a little different today, if you don't mind. Do you mind?
Not particularly.
Okay. You know how we sometimes do relative dimensions on this show? Remember when we talked about Rogue One? We talked about Star Wars?
Yeah.
I would like to do a relative dimension, if you don't mind. Because I have this award-winning poem. Oh. And by award-winning, I mean it won a tiny regional award at a local science fiction convention.
That is still an award.
It's an award.
It is true. I got a $50 Amazon gift certificate and my name on a website.
I would be totally down with winning that for a poem.
Well, thank you for your support. This has nothing to do with Doctor Who whatsoever, but it does have to do with one of my other interests, which is H.P. Lovecraft and the Cthulhu mythos. Have you guys heard of H.P. Lovecraft?
No.
Okay. Yeah,
of course I have.
He was working at about the same time as Laurel and Hardy.
Oh, yeah. Now I'm on board.
Okay. You know, jazz age. He's really a representative of the jazz age.
Was he sort of like, you know,
Langston Hughes?
Okay, I was thinking Harry Langdon, but okay.
There we go. Yeah.
H.P. Lovecraft speaks of rivers. I love that poem. Yep.
It's like
Caruso.
Harold Lloyd hanging off a clock.
Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton. So, okay, yeah, we're all on the same page here. Yeah. If you don't mind, for our wonderful afunctionalism / relative dimensions today, I would like you to all hear my award-winning poem, Things Your Child Was Not Meant to Know. Come hither, my child, and hearken to me, and we will enrich your vocabulary. Old Grandpa Tybald respects not your derrance, nor the mindless objections of idiot parents. A is for crumbling witch-haunted Arkham. B for Brown Jenkin, the vermin homunculum. C for Cthulhu and the chaos that crawls. D is for Dagon and Deep Ones and Dolls. E is for Ibon in the Vale of Panath. F for the fungi from frigid Yagoth. G is for ghouls and the grave sites they rob. H is for Howards. Both Lovecraft and Bob. I is for Innsmouth in fishy seclusion. J for von Junst's unesprechlichen Kulten. K for the wasteland of chilly Kadath. And L for lost Leng, the plateau without path. M for the mysteries Miskatonic men bury. N for Necronomicon in its secret library. O for the old ones, the great gods who rule you. P for Fenuriai Mifrenatha Cthulhu. Q for a question. What have I forgotten? R is the answer. S for the Shoggoths and the shapes they change freely, and T for their terrible tekalili. U is for Ulthar, where the cats are untouchable. V for Sign of Wurish, to watch the unwatchable. W for Wilbur and old wizard Waitley. X the xenogenic twin, unseen lately. Y for Yog-Sothoth, Yahanathlai, Yig. And Z for the Zoogs, who don't grow very big. That's all for tonight, but there's more, so much more, that lurks neath the bed and claws at the door. So sleep now, my child, and stifle your screams, and may the great old ones grant you great old sweet dreams. Okay, and so for our fifth and final round, we are returning to Arcs of Infinity. With the final two stories in the Eighth Doctor Time War box set. Mm. These are the stories The Conscript, written by Mac Fitton, and One Life, written by John Dorney, both directed by Ken Bentley. All four of these stories were written by the same two fellas, so Matt Fitton and John Dorney, who write a lot of Big Finish stuff, particularly Eighth Doctor ones. And I can only imagine that they work fairly closely together because these stories don't have a lot of the problems of collaborations that I see in other types of things of this type.
Which we can presume is why they do so much writing for Big Finish. If they can make things tight and unified like this, I mean, as a producer, why wouldn't you hire them?
Yeah, I think it's very glossy. I think it's very professional. I think sometimes their stuff feels a bit samey to me. I guess that's a little weird sounding because Doctor Who can be all of time and space, and we have lots of different actors doing different characters and different plots and yada, yada, yada. But there is a certain level of, I don't want to say it's like a lack of spark or whatever, but sometimes I feel that.
You said it. With Doctor Who, you're used to many, many voices, and Big Finish shrank the number of writer voices they use. If you look back at the first 50 Big Finish, when they were just starting out, not only did they have so many different writers, but they wrote in such disparate voices, from really radical scripts to really super traditional ones. And, I mean, the flip side of that is, when they failed far more spectacularly than current Big Finish stuff. They've raised the
minuets
standard.
In hell of the Big Finish.
Yeah, you pretty much don't have that anymore, but yet you do not have the highs either.
Yeah, and as is usual with Pat, I'm going to like come off strong and sound like I'm disapproving of this before walking that back a little bit and discussing about the things that I like about the story, because I thought this Time War sequence was actually very good. But
me too.
Yeah, but yes, it felt samey to me, and on a broader level, I'm starting to worry about what sorts of stories that can be told about the Doctor in the Time War. And I'm going to bracket that off for a little bit because I have more to say about that when we talk specifically about the Conscript. But just on a storytelling level for right now, this four-episode sequence and the War Doctor stuff that we listened to recently, most of them are about the Daleks and the Time Lords running around after one another looking for some type of super weapon or another. And I'm like, is that the only kind of war story that you can tell within the Doctor Who universe? Yeah, because this felt very War Doctory to me, particularly the fourth episode.
Yes. I will say, if you're talking about a different type of Time War story, my favorite of this whole set is the Conscript.
By far. Easily the best.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah. You sound surprised, Kelvin.
I didn't have that reaction.
But let's tell our listeners who maybe decided not to listen to this and just want to hear us talk about it for some reason. The Conscript is essentially the Eighth Doctor being drafted and being forced
into basic training.
Basic training. And last episode, we complained a little bit about the second episode being light on story and being pretty insubstantial. Here's the flip side of that. This is another one that I think is essentially pretty light on story and insubstantial, but the concept and the scenes and the character moments fill it.
Yeah.
It reminds me of Raymond Chandler said that he didn't write mysteries for the story. The mysteries were, did they provide great scenes? Often that showed in his books because his mysteries didn't make any sense. But he had fabulous scenes. And this story is just full of fabulous scene after fabulous scene.
I agree with all that, Joshua. For me, it was also a story that explicitly addresses one of the central problems of Doctor Who, and by extension, all heroic narratives in general, which is that they're not realistic. A hero narrative and a war narrative, those things aren't incompatible, obviously, but maybe they should be, because the combination gives rise to a lot of pernicious stuff and a lot of bad ideas about what conflict and war are about. And so I always had, you know, a little bit of kind of hero narratives are false. They give us a false sense of security, and it's not really how the real world operates.
But this story actually voices the anxiety between those two types of stories.
It really does. Very much so. Because, of course, the Doctor is doing his Doctor thing, and he's pushing against authority, as he always does. Yeah. But it's within the context of a boot camp basic training narrative, where not only on a micro level are all the other recruits going to be punished for whatever the Doctor's infringements are, but you have to wonder whether he's in the right at all. Is he actually right in taking a stand against this type of, he calls it indoctrination, but isn't this what you have to do to make soldiers who won't get themselves killed on the battlefield? They have to know how to shine their boots, because that's, they have to have attention to detail. They have to follow orders, because if they don't follow orders, as one of the recruits does not, following the Doctor's example, they get killed, as the recruit gets killed. So, yeah, that line from Serenity, again, a hero is someone who gets other people killed. The recruit, I forget his name, he doesn't have the same sort of narrative immunity that the Doctor does in his stories. No one does. No one in the real world has that narrative immunity, and so we have built structures in the military, for example, where if you accept the necessity of waging war, which is another moral question that we can return to, but if you accept it in the first place, certain things follow from that. And one of the things that follows is that you have to have a well-trained force that is going to follow your orders and subsume their individuality to the military. And that is fundamentally incompatible with the Doctor.
You cannot fight a war without that.
Right. And the Doctor is full of strange things that he's saying here. He, the drill sergeant, whose name escapes me right now, and he have several nice conversations.
He has a very human name, like Harlan?
Harlan.
Harlan. Okay. Yeah, so he and Harlan have a number of interesting conversations, which are, I think, among the best of Big Finish Doctor Who conversations that I've encountered.
Certainly in the Time War stories they've told.
Yeah, the Doctor says, I haven't fought in the war because I don't know what to do. And Harlan says, well, does that mean you're not going to do anything? Is that what your choice is, that you're not going to do anything? It's clearly, you know, a universe-ending apocalyptic thing of the nature that the Doctor usually fights all the time, but he doesn't know what the answer is, so he's staying out of it. But Harlan is training Gallifreyan troops to fight in the war. Isn't he doing something more positive than that, even if it does mean that people get sacrificed and people die? People get sacrificed and die in Doctor Who all the time. The Doctor is usually responsible for it.
But the Doctor expresses that is on such a scale, it is both intimidating and has kind of pushed him into a state of denial. He's just saying there has to be another way. He has no idea what it is.
Right.
And in most situations, that's how the Doctor runs. Like, there has to be another way. I'm going to improvise until I find it. And this is this conflict that he can't improvise through and resolve.
Yeah, it pushes against the narrative boundaries of what Doctor Who can be, if you're trying to do a real story within it. Because when you're doing science fiction and you're doing a war story, then you kind of have to set parameters. Otherwise, anything goes, yeah. Right? And usually in Doctor Who, you can resolve it at the end of an episode or two by inventing some crazy super weapon that's going to roll back time, or mm-hmm. or you're going to teleport Gallifrey out of the way of the invading Dalek forces. There's usually something
yeah.
to be done there, but that's not really how wars are fought. You know, the Time War doesn't end because of the fall of Berlin or the Treaty of Westphalia or something like that. It ends because Stephen Moffat invents something called the moment that can be played by Billy Piper so that you can bring that story to an end. But there's a narrative tension in Doctor Who, and there's a real-world tension in how wars actually operate, and those things are really fighting against each other in this episode. And I think, Kelvin, to get back to why I like it so much, it's because that's irresolvable. Mm-hmm. It's narratively irresolvable, but they go ahead and they do it anyway. They have people talking about exactly yeah. those things, and they dramatize the consequences. And you're never really sure whether the Doctor's right or wrong mm-hmm. about...
They don't come down on anyone's side. If anything, they sort of split the difference at the end, where they sort of decide, well, I guess some people are more prone to being soldiers and others aren't. They give the soldiers the option to retreat, those who want to and don't feel ready to fight, and those who feel ready to fight get to make the choice to go and fight. But that's something very big in Doctor Who, too, is having that choice.
Having a choice. And, that,
and not being indoctrinated.
And that's the moral decision that the Doctor is able to give. He allows them to have the choice, mm-hmm. whereas Elestra and Harlan are like, you're mm-hmm. going to go up there and you're going to die mm-hmm. fighting the Dalek ships. But we're never sure as listeners whether that's the right decision mm-hmm. or not, because we don't know what the parameters are in this war. Yeah, and mm-hmm. we don't know if there's a super weapon around the corner mm-hmm. that would mean that they didn't need to sacrifice themselves.
And the whole argument is given more weight by the fact that Harlan seems to suggest that he has sympathies toward the Doctor's point of view.
Yeah,
without ever backing off yeah. of his point of view.
He spontaneously says that the Doctor is not a coward mm-hmm. because somebody had given the Doctor the equivalent of the white feather.
The moon blossom?
Yeah, moon blossom.
Or whatever it was.
It's a Gallifreyan moon blossom of yeah. some type. But it's the equivalent to the World War I white feather that they would give to conscientious objectors to shame them if they weren't fighting on the front. But Harlan doesn't believe that at all.
He suggests he's a hero of the old Gallifrey.
Right.
That we have to change with this war.
And the story works, too, because everyone's acting, except maybe Elestra, but even her probably, we think that everyone is acting in good conscience. It's not like anyone here is a sadist or a war profiteer, or
no,
some of these
super villainous in this story.
Yeah, we accept that Elestra and Harlan are doing this for the purposes that they state,
yeah,
which
yeah.
is to win the war
yeah.
at all costs.
Yeah.
And because of that, your moral calculus is changed.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be easier if they were secret Dalek agents.
In some ways, the moral conflict seems quintessential Doctor Who, but the way they approach it seems very atypical for Doctor Who, and I think that's what makes it feel like such a strong Doctor Who story. At the same time, they're just really funny scenes. I mean, the Doctor being in boot camp and just being a dick is
he starts
hilarious.
A food fight.
Yeah, he starts a food fight. And so
yeah.
on top of all this huge moral dilemma and heady discussions, we just have funny scenes. And it's really nice to see the Eighth Doctor get to be funny and disrespectful.
Yeah.
Because he's been put in yeah. a lot of really serious situations.
That's
and this
true.
Is a really serious situation. So I love this. I kind of want to talk more about it, but I also, in case any listener is curiosity is piqued by this, I don't want to give too much
yeah.
away because I think it's a fantastic story.
I think so, too. And I think maybe we should not talk a lot about One Life
mm-hmm.
then for exactly this reason where, I mean, we could give away how this storyline ends, but maybe we should just leave it for our listeners.
We can talk about our general opinion yeah. of how it concludes, but yeah, I would like to encourage people to listen to this, particularly new series fans and particularly people who are interested in the Time War.
I guess I will say I thought it was a respectable end to the Time War story
yeah.
and leads into other areas that I think are going to be interesting. It did not lead directly into the moment from Day of the Doctor as I thought it was going to. I guess that's a spoiler, but I sort of thought that
yeah.
was the direction that things were going.
I think that would be kind of a weird continuity thing.
There's just so many super weapons. I can't keep track of them.
Right.
Anymore.
And if anything, that is the weakness as you mentioned at the beginning of this discussion of the Big Finish Time War stories.
We know where
it
is
goes. The super weapons. It's well, always that. The super weapons. Mm-hmm. That being said, I think this final installment works very well with the other three stories.
Yeah.
It's not really a super weapon.
It's kind of a mediocre weapon.
It's not a weapon. It's just a situation.
A moment.
That has happened that they were trying to exploit.
I think it's a better super weapon idea than some of the other ones we've listened to, but there's a little bit of exhaustion from hearing similar stories, even though I think this one might be better than a lot of the
previous ones. It's not like the War Doctor story when the Daleks are going to throw 50 planets at Gallifrey.
Oh, I love that. That was awesome. That was the planet machine gun.
Like, what the
fuck? Although there is a jaw-dropping, wonderful little weapon in the fourth episode, too, with the Daleks quantum weapon, whatever they call it, whatever. It's amazing.
The quantum thing to create a barrier?
Yeah, they create a barrier around the solar system by doing a probabilistic quantum attack on themselves or something that splits them into an infinite number of Dalek ships that reaches backward and forward to every point in time.
So they can't leave because there's this Dalek ship solid in the
solid wall. Dalek ship surrounding the sphere around the solar system at every moment in time. It's like, wow. Like, you see, okay, that seems hard to defeat.
This is why I was a little down on the conscript. And it's kind of a problem I have with military science fiction in general. And it's just kind of extra exaggerated in the Doctor Who universe because you've got god levels of science here. I cannot buy that the army would just be put together like a World War II platoon. I cannot buy that.
I'm with you. I thought it was probably a Matrix, like, simulation.
Yeah.
And they were being pumped full of body changing. I mean, like,
you know, they're polishing boots. They're marching and singing the little march chants.
Which were hilarious, they were funny. By the way.
They were funny, but I just, like, why?
I thought this was, like, the Deadly Assassin portrayal of Gallifrey, which is just a huge satire of
that
British
that
politics.
Was different because that's, like, yeah, I mean, that's politics. That's not, like, I guess I'm caught up in the technology and the hardware and that.
No,
and
I get you, Kelvin. I think you have a more kind of realist frame of reference than I do. Like, for me,
yeah.
They built a universe and a situation that allows this philosophical discussion to occur.
It's just the weird juxtaposition of, like, you know, the crazy things like the infinite quantum Dalek ships.
Right, right.
And then, you know.
And that's science
and
then fantasy.
The Time Lord's like, well, we got to fight this. What do we do? Well, let's do some marching drills. You know, I just don't get that.
Totally get you, but in all fairness to this story and Big Finish, they are going with what Stephen Moffat established in Day of the Doctor. And I shared your same disappointment. All this talk of the Time War and it's just soldiers with guns.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But now I've sort of accepted that fact. And if you're going to accept that fact, like, the conscript is the perfect version of Doctor Who doing that.
The Time War is so enormous that it would have these cosmic scale things happening and then just, you know, probably guys just shooting at each other.
And it's part of the Doctor's outrage in this. These guys are being trained to kind of be fodder.
Yeah, which is the case with most wars.
Mm-hmm.
As with a lot of Doctor Who, you really just kind of lie back and take it. Once it's established in Day of the Doctor that the Time War is just basically some bullshit war story that we've seen before, then it's like, okay, now that I've got that, then I can, you know, at least for me, I'm like, okay, I guess I accept the stories.
Yeah, I got caught up in the logic part of it, not the satire part of it.
Yeah, go back and listen to it for the satire.
Whereas, you know, Deadly Assassin, I'm like totally on board with the satire part.
You've had more time to process it.
I've had more time. I saw the Deadly Assassin when I was a kid.
Yes.
40 years from now, you are going to love the hell out of this.
Look back on the conscript and go, oh.
We're just a bunch of 90-year-old guys who really like Doctor Who. Boy, I got to say, that first Time War box set, oh, that was a cracker.
Well, folks, that's another one in the can. Next time, we'll be having a special guest of some sort.
Who, Kelvin?
Tell us more.
Will it be you? No, come on. Don't be stupid. No, but we will have
we
a guest.
We don't even know you.
Yeah, we don't.
Seriously.
Who are you people?
Why are you taking my mail? Who are you? But anyway, we will be having a guest next time. And until then, I'm Kelvin.
I'm Pat.
And I'm Joshua.
And we're saying,
get off my world.
If you don't mind, my award-winning poem, things your child was not meant to know. And Josh, if you wouldn't mind putting some appropriately spooky ambient background music behind this.
Okay. Yakety sax it is.
Come hither, my child, and hearken to me, and we will enrich your vocabulary. Old Grandpa Tybald respects not your derrance, nor the mindless objections of idiots.